Nuketown Radioactive number 72 for Sunday, September 28th, 2008. In this edition of Nuketown Radioactive, life slowly gets back to normal as I head into the fall semester and start to remember, oh yeah, I do have some hobbies that I like to do. One of those hobbies? Playing role-playing games. And I'll be checking out the latest edition of Dungeons & Dragons by Wizards of the Coast. Yes, I've finally finished that long-delayed review. Welcome to Nuketown Radioactive. I'm your host, Ken Newquist. This is the occasional podcast about life, liberty, and the pursuit of gaming, and this is what happens when I have a week's vacation. That's right, I am actually off from work this week, and because of that, you guys get another episode of Nuketown Radioactive in a timely manner. How insane is that? And actually, right now, I'm able to record this for one reason. Well, actually, technically two. Jordan is at kindergarten, and Luke is taking a nap. Now, I don't know what adventures Luke has been up to while getting ready to take his nap. Earlier this weekend, he decided that he needed to, take care of some reorganization type stuff, and decided to take all of the clean laundry that was in his pants/shorts drawer and dump it into the laundry basket, which I didn't find out about until the next day when I thought, hey, you know what? I thought I did that laundry yesterday, and Jordan, whom I'd asked to pick out some clothes for Luke to help me get him dressed, said, hey, Dad, Luke doesn't have any clean shorts. Like, that's got to be insane. Of course he has shorts. How could he not have shorts? Well, it turns out that the way he cannot have shorts is to have put them all into the laundry basket. So this is what life with Luke is right now. He is well into his toddler years, and he's starting to get that independent streak, and he started to really want to do things himself, including washing his hands. That's his big thing right now, is he likes to go upstairs and wash his hands in the sink, to the point where the other day I told him, okay, Lukey, let's go wash your hands, and I'm getting ready to go up the stairs with him, and he stops and says, no, Daddy, no, and he pulls out his hands in front of him as if to hold me off, and pushes his hands against my knees and just says no. I thought, well, okay, sure, you go do that. So, you know, obviously I have to check in on him in 5 minutes or so to make sure that he hasn't flooded the bathroom, but it's pretty cool. We've also started that wonderful trek known as potty training. We aren't going completely hardcore on this. I know some parents can get a little insane when it comes to potty training. Our approach is really more, they have to want it. And if they're interested in potty training, then we try and encourage that. And right now, Luke is interested. He's not doing a really great job of it so far. You know, he's kind of got the cause and effect thing a little bit off, but he's interested. And, you know, if that means we spend 5-10 minutes hanging out at the potty, reading books, playing with cars, whatever, you know, I'm up to do that, because it is a process. It takes a while, and, you know, I don't think there's anything you can really do to force it to happen. It just kind of seems to happen when it happens. So it'd be awesome if he started to do it now, because I don't know about the rest of you parents out there, but it is really nice when you don't have to pay for diapers anymore. But hey, you know what? If it takes until 3 to do it, that's okay too. So I have a geek dad, geek pride moment that I want to share with you guys. And no, it's not the potty training thing. The other day, Jordan had one of her friends over, and the two girls were talking, and one of the girls says, hey, I want to play a game. Let's play chess. And the other girl says, hey, I want to play ponies. Guess which one was my kid? Unfortunately, it wasn't really the perfect time for them to play chess. It has a lot of pieces. Luke was running amok, and I really didn't want to be finding chess pieces for the rest of the day. I was also on my own because Sue had gone away for the weekend to hang out with some other moms down at the beach, and, you know, just a little too much chaos for me to handle at that moment. But I was really proud that Jordy wanted to play chess. We've actually been playing a fair amount of chess. I think we've probably been playing about one game a week, and that has me once again thinking about getting a nice sturdy chess set. The one we have right now is kind of flimsy, made out of plastic, better than the glass chess set that we had been playing with, but the pieces just aren't that sturdy, and we're missing two bishops. So ultimately, I would really like to upgrade and get a nice set, a nice plastic set with you know, a nice heavy weighted pieces with a nice rollout board that similar to the kind that I had when I was in high school. But alas, you know, I think that may have to wait until my birthday. But it's been nice to play. I actually, let's see, just on Saturday, Jordy checkmated me. Now, obviously, I spotted her a few pieces, and I helped show her exactly how to get her pieces into position so that she could do the checkmate. But she was very excited that she got the checkmate, and she's really starting to grasp some of the positioning type things. She's starting to understand the value of protecting certain pieces. She hasn't gotten to the point where she's ready to trade pieces and seeing the tactical value of trading pieces. She also hasn't quite gotten to the point where she's grasping the positional aspects of chess, where you're trying to control certain aspects of the board. But on the other hand, she knows how all the pieces move, and she's starting to say, "Oh, well, you know, I want to make sure that no one's going to threaten my queen." And she's actually using that term, which is pretty cool. I gotta say, it's so cool to actually be sitting down and playing chess. Now, with my crazy busy summer, I have been trying to streamline things a little bit, reorganize my office, and reorganize my bookshelf. I think by the time we got to about mid-August, I was looking at the bookshelf, and for those of you who aren't familiar with the bookshelf, it is this rather large wall-attached unit. One side of it is Sue's books, with a couple of kids' books thrown in. In the middle is Doi Doi's fish tank, which would be our turtle. He has this fish tank slash terrarium slash island thing that he hangs out on, and then the other side is my bookshelf. And I had just kind of been piling stuff up there all summer, and I was sitting there and I was looking at it and going, you know what, I've got stacks of books everywhere. I should really reorganize this bookshelf a little bit to make it more effective. It's nice to be able to kind of have people see the kind of books that I'm interested in and kind of show off my science fiction side, right, when folks come over. It can be a nice conversation piece when you know, folks stop by for our Christmas party or whatever. But at the same time, this is this big chunk of space that really could be used better and that I could use to store my stuff while I'm working on things downstairs, if I'm working on book reviews, whatever. So what I basically did was went in and took out some of the Stephen King books that I haven't read in 15 years, brought them upstairs to the gaming room until I could figure out a place to put them, and that cleared out enough space to put in my Star Wars role-playing game books. It cleared out some space for the RPGs that I'm presently reviewing. It has some space now for books that are on my to-do list. Yes, I'm slowly finishing my summer reading list. And yes, I know that it's fall now, but what can I say? My summer reading list was made up almost entirely of books that I didn't get done with the first time around. And I gotta say, with some of this stuff, it's not any easier the second time around. But in any case, it's just a nice place now to store my stuff. So now I've got a better place to store my stuff, and if you're wondering why the tone of my voice just changed, it's because, well, the phone rang, and of course I got sidetracked, and now, a week later, I'm back to the podcast, and lo and behold, I have a cold. So, fortunately, the cold is in retreat right now, but alas, the voice is not in such great shape. So, since it is a week later, I can happily report that NukemCon was a tremendous success. NukemCon, for those of you who may not remember, is the homegrown gaming convention that my friends and I do. Basically, we get our whole gaming group together, as well as a few other friends, and we play games for an entire weekend. So this past weekend, from Friday through Sunday, we played, Serenity, Deadlands Reloaded, Aces and Eights, Dungeons and Dragons, Illuminati, a lot of Battletech. Let's see what else. We got a little Halo, like the original old school, the pistol can kill you in three shots Halo. And a little bit of other things in here I can't remember off the top of my head, but in any case, it went really, really well. I had a blast playing Serenity. I really can't wait to play it again. There's a new Serenity Adventures book out, actually, that I want to pick up. It's only in PDF now, but the print should be coming out soon. And my hope is I can just, you know, run that either with my gaming group with one-shots, you know, maybe at the next NewcomCon, maybe on a Saturday in the winter, or maybe get some sci-fi western type folks together, as I know a few, and run it with them. So we'll see. But in any case, NewcomCon was just a heck of a lot of fun. Totally exhausting. I'm still recovering from it. I think I'm a little burned out on high level D&D now. We've been doing more of it lately since we wanted to see, well, how well does it work? Is it really problematic? And I think for my group, it actually works really well. Everybody had a lot of fun with it. We were able to tie up a loose plot that had been kind of hanging out there for years. And everybody had a lot of fun, but for me, it was just exhausting to put together. I worked with two other DMs in the group. There were three of us all told to put together this adventure, which was spanned two nights, Saturday night and Friday night. And while it was a lot of fun, it was also a lot of work. And I think I'm ready to just kind of put that on the back burner for a month or two until my creative juices come flowing back and I have a desire to do high-level D&D again. But in any case, it was a great time, and I wholeheartedly recommend to anyone who has a gaming group that you should try it. You know, maybe not for the whole weekend, maybe to start, you just take a Saturday and you play two or three different games. It's awesome for the kind of players like me who really want to try out some different stuff, but you can't do it in your weekly game because everybody wants to play D&D or everybody wants to play GURPS or whatever. You know, everybody says they want to try something new, but when it comes down to it, you know, what you've got is D&D. Well, that's okay. With game days like this, you can roll out the kind of stuff that, you know, you only get to play once a year or twice a year, or that game you bought at Gen Con 3 years ago and really never got a chance to sit down and do anything with. And everybody's excited about it because, hey, it's a one-shot, you know? It's something new. So overall, great experience. Recommend it. Please. If you get the opportunity, try it with your group. You will not regret it. So there's one last thing I wanted to ask folks about before I move on to the D&D 4th edition review. Yes, that still is happening in the podcast, so bear with me. But my question for you is this. Should I bring back the Radiations newsletter? This was an email newsletter that I put out for a goodly number of years, and it had the advantage of, you know, going into people's inboxes and reminding them that the site existed, that there was new stuff up. Over the last couple of years, I kind of phased it out, mostly because RSS kind of took over, and I figured most of the people who are interested in keeping up with the site would use RSS, and there are about 70 odd people who are following the site using RSS. But you know, I used to have 300-400 people on the mailing list, and I guess I just want to know, what do you think, guys? And do you want to have the new email newsletter come back? I know I certainly am subscribed to a number of site newsletters, and I find that it's really good for reminding me that site exists. I don't always get to check out my RSS feeds, but I usually check out my email once a day, so it kind of works for me. But I want to know if it works for you. So you can send me feedback on it at nuketown@gmail.com.
If you need help with your master plan, check out rpgpodcast.com.
So before I get into my own review of Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition, I thought I would give you a rundown of what else is out on the web. First of all, you can stop by Steve Jackson Games Pyramid at www.sjgames.com/pyramid. This is a subscription webzine that's published once a week, so you will, and it does require a subscription, so you do need to pay in order to be able to read the articles, but I've found that they've always had top-notch reviews and really good coverage of a lot of different games, including both board games and role-playing games, so it's definitely worth checking out, not just for the Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition review, but just as a good webzine that gets you just a huge amount of information about what's going on out on the web. If you don't want to pay the subscription, though, there are plenty of other review sites that have talked about Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition. First of all, on the podcast front, you've got the Tomes reviews of the Player's Handbook, the Monster Manual, and the Dungeon Master's Guide. The Game the Thing, episode 34, has a discussion of Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition. Investigating Mind Games, volume 1, number 7, JJ and Sean talk about 4th edition. That's over at fistfulofcomics.com. Let's see, Virtual Play over at virtualplay.podbus.com. Their episode number 29 has a review of Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition. Web Caplets, which is an awesome podcast that just offers quick 5 to 10 minute, if that, podcasts on a variety of gaming topics. Well, episode 19, they did the obligatory Dungeons & Dragons 4E episode. In terms of print reviews, you can check out my review of Dungeons & Dragons over on sci-fi.com. This was it was shorter. I think it was maybe 700, 800 words. And I think probably a very balanced review in my own humble opinion. But it didn't go quite into the depth that I would have liked, but you only have so many words. I also did a follow-up review on Nuketown, which you can find at nuketown.com. It's actually the featured article right now on the homepage, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes. This review is far more extensive. It's really very lengthy, and it tries to pull together all of the playtest reports that I did on Nuketown into one comprehensive review. There's also been a fairly good comment thread that it spawned. I think there were about 14-odd comments that people made about the site, or about the review, which was pretty cool. We had a nice conversation about it, both pro 4E, anti 4E, and a bunch of folks kind of like me who fall in the middle. In terms of, let's see, other podcasts, we have Pulp Gamer has their impressions of 4th edition up on their site, which you can find at pulpgamer.com. And finally, if you're really into 4E, you want to know what's going on, you want to be able to have folks go on a blow-by-blow analysis of the different adventuring classes and such, then you're going to need to check out Radio Free Homlet at homlet.com. Now, links to all of these will be in the show notes, and I strongly recommend that you check them out, because I have links directly to the shows in the show notes, not just the sites. So that should make catching up with all the 4E goodness, all that much easier.
Cannon Puncture is the best role-playing game podcast ever made. No, really. Sturm Brightblade said so.
Dude, Sturm is dead.
Oh, yeah. Man, that sucks.
Cannon Puncture's pretty good, though.
Oh, yeah.
And now, Nuketown's review of Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition. There's an old Star Trek acronym called IDIC. It stands for Infinite Diversity and Infinite Combinations. And the Vulcans went and made it their holy symbol. Dungeons & Dragons 3rd edition was all about IDIC, with infinite combinations of characters played out across thousands of campaigns and dozens of different game systems. Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition is about FDFC, Finite Diversity in Finite Combinations. It's about focusing the game on a certain style of play, making it easier, faster, and more streamlined, but at the cost of limiting player options. The 30-level sweet spot. The goals of 4th edition have been articulated many times by its designers. They wanted to expand D&D's sweet spot, the happy place where rules complexity balanced perfectly against ease of play, from the 5th to 12th level of 3rd edition to 1st to 30th in 4th edition. They wanted to get rid of the 5-minute workday, in which spellcasters blew all their spells in one big combat, and then the heroes retreated back to their castles or guild halls to rest, recover, and then do it all again. The net result of which was to unbalance the wizards and clerics versus the other class by giving them their very best powers in every combat. The designers wanted to speed up play by limiting player choices, overhauling complicated subsystems, and gutting the magic system to its core essentials. They wanted to encourage teamwork by providing players with reasons and mechanics to work together. To accomplish these goals, they fearlessly, and some would argue recklessly and callously as well, gutted Dungeons & Dragons down to its very core. They've ditched 30 years of game design, negating much of what was in Advanced Dungeons & Dragons and 3rd Edition, in favor of new exceptions-based design that borrows equally from collectible card games and World of Warcraft. Glancing through the rules, this may seem like hyperbole. After all, many of the core concepts that have been in the game since the beginning are still there. Familiar classes like Fighter, Wizard, Rogue, and Ranger exist alongside new ones like Warlords and Warlocks. The same goes for the core races, with Dwarves, Elves, and Humans returning along these new species, such as Dragonborn and Tieflings. There are still the three core rulebooks, the Player's Handbook, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual, and even a few of the old gods survived into the new era. It's how all this is implemented that will have diehard 3E players clutching their dice bags in horror and screaming, "No, not on my watch, they don't, not on my watch," while others, less enthralled or perhaps just tired of the previous 8 years of D&D, look on with interest. A shattered reflection. The changes are legion. Every class in 4th edition now has a suite of powers it can evoke on and off the battlefield, though primarily on. Powers are divided into at will, which are usable whenever you like, encounter, which are usable once per fight, daily, usable once per day, and utility, secondary buff type powers usable in or out of combat, and usually once per day. In a move towards the exception-based rules of a collectible card game, in which you have one core set of rules and then every card in the game in some way breaks those rules, these powers now act pretty much the same way. Each power breaks the rules in some small way, allowing an extra attack, providing some battlefield effect, or some other advantage to the character. Each class has two power trees associated with it, occasionally perhaps three. For example, wizards can pick from a striker or controller types, rangers can balance expertise with ranged attacks against the ability to fight with two melee weapons, and rogues decide between taking a brawny or deceptive approach to adventuring. Classes gain these powers in lockstep with one another, which provides a sort of inherent balance to the system because everybody can do the same number of amazing things every day. This blows away the varying levels of complexity seen in 3rd edition, and then re-zeroes it, raising the low end, the simple, straightforward, one-trick pony characters such as fighters or barbarians, and lowering the high end, the ultra-complex characters such as wizards and clerics, with their exceedingly deep spell lists in 3rd edition. With classes no longer distinguished by their complexity, the emphasis changes to their role in combat. Each is divided into a number of different roles that anyone should be familiar with who's played Warcraft or some other massively multiplayer online game. You've got defenders, such as fighters and paladins, who serve the traditional tank role and are good at dealing out damage and getting others to attack them. There are the strikers, such as rogues and rangers, which are good at doing lots of damage quickly, then moving on. Leaders, such as warlords and clerics, allow their allies to receive extra actions and additional healing, and controllers, such as wizards, are experts at manipulating the layout of the battlefield and affecting large numbers of creatures. This role and exceptions-based approach extends to the monster manual. While every monster has some sort of basic melee or ranged attack, each also has a suite of powers that are unique to that particular monster, or in some cases, his species. Unlike 3rd edition, in which monsters played by the same rules as players, in 4th edition, every monster's rules, like every player's powers, are a mini rule set onto themselves. There's no reason to look up, say, how concealment works for a displacer beast, because everything a DM needs to know about that power can be found in the monster's stat block. Some of the spell depth of the cleric and wizard classes returns in the form of rituals. Rituals allow the casting of old-style utility spells such as Animal Messenger and Raise Dead outside of combat. Rituals require a special ritual caster feat to use, and most, but not all, require some sort of a skill check to cast. Clerics and wizards get the rituals for free, but anyone can cast them assuming they have enough ranks in the skill that's key to the ritual. Another major change is the concept of tiers. The game is now divided into three tiers: Heroic, which is levels 1 to 10, Paragon, which is levels 11 to 20, and Epic, which are levels 21 to 30. Minor tweaks to character bonuses and difficulty classes, which represent how difficult it is to accomplish a task, accompany each tier, and each has an eye toward keeping things as challenging at 30th level as they were at first. New powers also open up at these different tiers. At Paragon, characters get access to Paragon Paths, which represent specialized abilities not unlike 3rd edition's prestige classes, while the Epic tier introduces Epic Destinies, the goal or fate that the character hopes to accomplish as they accumulate truly cosmic power, such as ascending to demigodhood. Magic items are keyed to character level and are designed to complement a character's abilities on different tiers. Thus, you have level 3 swords that might have a minor flame ability on par with heroic tier powers, as well as level 25 swords capable of rending an enemy's soul. Nothing stops a player from holding on to old magic items, but the assumption is that, as in video games, players will trade up for better items as the campaign progresses. There are lesser changes. Saving throws are all but gone, having been replaced by fortitude, reflex, and will defenses. This inverts the normal order of things from previous editions of the game. Instead of defenders trying to evade effects, attackers are now trying to overcome defenses. Saving throws remain in a vestigial role. Ongoing effects in the game, such as being slowed or put to sleep, now getting saving throw each round. It's a generic save. Everyone tries to get a 10 or better on a d20 roll, with no modifiers for abilities and such, and it mostly exists for bookkeeping reasons. Action dice, seen in Wizards of the Coast D20 Modern and Unearthed Arcana, as well as Eberron, are now part of the core rules of 4E. At Heroic tier, players can spend an action point to take another standard action, and at Paragon tier, players gain additional ways to spend them. Embracing finite character design. So how does the game play? Well, assuming you can put aside its radical departure from Dungeons & Dragons' 3-decade history, the answer is pretty well. On the character side, it's easier and quicker to create a character under 4th edition than it was under 3rd, mostly because on average there are fewer options to choose from. There are some cases where that doesn't hold true. It's almost impossible to create a one-trick pony warrior, simply because even the dumb fighter types have enough powers to make them dangerous. On the other end of the spectrum, though, and this is where some of the greatest time savings are, clerics and wizards have far fewer options to choose from, especially at high levels. The stripped down, one might say desiccated, skills system makes choosing skills a 5-minute task, but the lack of profession, craft, and performance skills that means that players looking to give their characters some tradecraft abilities are going to be out of luck in this game. Fisherman turned adventurer? Sorry, sir, we've only got room for heroes in this game. Now, as some pointed out in comments on the discussion thread on Nuketown, you can always write these kind of things into your backstory. But in my gaming group, we've actually had folks who've taken profession skills, such as stoneworking, gem cutting, that kind of thing, and use them in game, which we find really enhanced the game overall, and it was nice to be able to have that option. In 4th edition, not so much. While creating a character is easier, Wizards blew an opportunity to make it a lot easier by failing to define critically important terms before getting into the classes chapter. Specifically, while the start of chapter overview talks about attacks and hits, they never actually define such critical concepts as basic melee attack, basic ranged attack, and the cryptic W. The basic attack types are referred to time and again in the powers descriptions, but we don't get definitions of them until you get to the combat chapter in the last quarter of the book. More glaring was the W designation, which was used in the hit sections of each power. Everyone in my gaming group fumbled when trying to figure out what this meant, and ultimately had to go digging through the combat chapter to learn that it means weapon damage. So 1W means the normal damage that your weapon does on a hit. 2W means that the power causes you to do twice normal damage. These are small things, but if they tripped up veteran players, I expect they'd trip up newbies as well. I'm tempted to quibble over the starting races featured in the book. I was sad to see the gnomes go. But if you're going to remake a game, these sorts of losses are expected. Classes, though, are another matter. The Player's Handbook had the subtitle Arcane, Divine, and Martial Classes. This means that, by design, they've left out nature or primal-based classes, such as the Druid and the Barbarian, as well as skillful classes like the Bard. They've also gotten rid of the traditional wizard schools, meaning that necromancers and illusionists have been kicked to the curb. To me, this leaves a gaping hole in their product and makes it difficult to run certain kinds of campaigns. For example, when we began discussing our 4E playtest campaign, I suggested hurling our group backwards in time 3,000 years to Greyhawk's ancient past. The party would play the calls to their modern-day Conans and do battle against the terrible Urfland druid necromancers of the era, the greatest of whom was a terrible necromancer, Vecna. Unfortunately, there are no druids or necromancers in 4th edition. There are no noble barbarians to oppose the Urfland overlords, and there are no bards to sing of their exploits. If I tried hard, really hard, I could have cobbled something together, but the point is that I shouldn't have to. Instead, we ditched the campaign idea, saving it instead for our playtest of Pathfinder from Paizo in 2009, and went with a planar campaign instead. Though, by default, I used the Planescape cosmology rather than 4E's own stripped-down cosmology. The Dungeon Master's Respite. 4th edition's greatest improvements are on the Dungeon Master's side of the screen. 4E is considerably easier to prep for than 3rd edition. This is because 4th edition's exception-based design truly shines with the monsters. There's no longer any need to flip through the book, or rather, the three core books, looking for rules, spells, and special ability descriptions like there was with 3rd edition. Now everything you need to run a monster is on the same page as the monster, which is just a huge thing. At the same time, there's a better mix of generic monsters, including some non-monster species like humans, dragonborn, and elves. Almost all of the typical encounters I found myself statting out under 3rd edition, such as a battle with human rabble led by a cultist, could be accommodated by the generic entries in the monster manual with only a handful of tweaks. Statting NPCs and figuring monster abilities easily accounted for the majority of my game prep time under 3rd edition. Under 4E, I was able to write out and stat each week's adventure in about an hour, rather than the 2 to 3 that was typical for low to mid-level characters in the previous edition. The Dungeon Master's Guide does a good job of explaining to new DMs exactly what their job is, and offers plenty of advice on how to do it. From an instructional standpoint, this is probably the best DMG ever. Another nice touch is that it introduces ad hoc rules for skill checks and improvised attacks. It offers suggested difficulty classes for easy, medium, and hard tasks, and the corresponding damage. It's a great idea, and it addresses the sort of issues that came up fairly frequently in our D&D campaign. Of course, it's also the sort of thing that DMs have been winging for years, but it's nice to have a handy table to look things up on. Going hand-in-hand with this are skill challenges, which take a combat-like approach to social and physical challenges, such as negotiating a treaty, searching for a contact in a city, or evading a patrol of orcs. The idea is that the Dungeon Master comes up with possible uses for skills tied to a task, such as diplomacy or streetwise when hunting down a contact. The DM also picks out some skills that just won't work, like, say, intimidating, which simply scares the contact underground. The goal of the characters is to achieve a certain number of successes before a certain number of failures, with the target numbers having been set when the challenge begins. I have seen more than a few people complaining that this reduces what should be role-playing to a series of dice rolls, but for me it didn't play that way. Instead, it played out as a framework that encouraged role-playing. Instead of some talk followed by a single sink-or-swim die roll, as often happened in 3rd edition, 4E sets up a lengthy encounter that players had to work through, bringing in their various storytelling and skill checks to the table, which was pretty cool. Skill challenges themselves are nothing new. We've seen them in other games, as well as in Unearthed Arcana under 3rd edition, but they're now an integral part of 4E. That's a good thing, but it would have been a better thing if they'd gotten the rules right the first time around. Within weeks of 4E's release, players found that, as written, skill challenges pretty much doom players to failure at almost every encounter. Wizards acknowledge the problem and quickly release errata that dealt with the problem, but it's still troubling that this made it through the playtest process and annoying that I now have to have a printout handy when running the game. Aside from the problems with skill challenges and the ad hoc table, the DMG takes a major hit in usability with its substandard index. The 3.5 DMG had a 4-page index with a 4th page dedicated almost entirely to listing tables and sidebars that appeared in the book. The 4E index is a single page, and it has no table listing. Actually, all the 4E books suffer from this problem, as does their Star Wars line. So I can only assume that Wizards of the Coast has decided that sneaking in an extra page or three of content is more important than making their books more usable. I fundamentally and vehemently disagree. Battle for the Tabletop. A lot has been made about the streamlining, if you like 4E, or dumbing down, if you don't, of Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition. Well, I think the game's made strides in reworking some of the more time-consuming aspects of 3rd Edition combat. During our playtest, the game proved to be every bit as complex as before, just in different ways. The sometimes cumbersome subsystems that always had people reaching for their rulebooks, turning, grapple, trip, are all gone and replaced with one-roll mechanics that aren't as detailed as 3E, but are adequate for the task at hand. Limiting how many abilities each player has access to, particularly with the arcane and divine casters, speeds things up by giving people less things to think about in any given combat. Though it's important to note that in some cases, like our dumb fighter friend, some characters are more complex than their 3rd edition counterparts. The fact that each monster has its complete abilities in a stat block is a great help to the GM, and the time savings there allow 4E to encourage a more diverse encounter build. You rarely have just a band of goblins, but instead have several different kinds of goblins, from melee fighters to arcane casters, augmented by wolves or wargs. Suggested warbands are listed alongside each monster in the monster manual, which is also a huge time saver. Some have said that having this diverse mix of monsters slows down 4E because there are now a lot more abilities to keep track of than, say, a homogeneous group of monsters. But in my experience, the compact stat blocks ran well. The biggest problem we ran into was monsters that seemed to have too many hit points. Several of my combats ran 3 or 4 rounds longer than they needed to, and by the end of the playtest campaign, I'd started to shave hit points to speed things up. This was most obvious with run-of-the-mill grunt monsters. The solo white dragon the party fought seemed to have just the right amount of hit points. The place where the complexity really begins to creep back into the game, first in drabs and then in a torrent, is with the mark mechanic. Half the classes in the game have some ability that allows them to mark a monster in some way. For example, a fighter marks a monster and then compels it to attack him instead of someone else. A warlock curses a monster and gets to teleport anywhere on the battlefield when that monster dies. It's a mechanic ripped from massively multiplayer online role-playing games, and it works well there because the computer's doing all the tracking. In the real world, it spawned a dozen tokens as we tried to figure out who had done what. 4E has done a good job of eliminating the save versus do nothing for 3 hours effect in 3rd edition. This is when spells like confusion, hold person, or sleep would knock a player out for a few rounds, which in turn meant the controlling player got to twiddle his or her thumbs while everyone else fought for an hour or two. In 4E, we didn't encounter any effects that behave this way. Even sleep doesn't immediately drop those who succumb to it. Instead, it requires multiple saves over several rounds. The worst thing we encountered was an immobilizer effect, which prevented a character from moving, but still allowed him or her to act. Similarly, there are effects that reduce characters' effectiveness, but they almost always had something that they could do. A direct consequence, however, seems to be that there are an awful lot of effects and conditions flying around the board. I took to tearing up index cards, writing down common conditions for that night's game, and then handing them out as they took effect. It wasn't a huge amount of bookkeeping, but it did did slow things down. Finally, it's hard to overstate the role of teamwork in this game. Every class has abilities that feed off of other characters, and it's critically important for everyone to keep track of what's going on, so that they can A, take advantage of it, and B, set up their allies as needed. There was some of this in 3rd edition, but in 4E, it's much more important. This is particularly true with the more powerful encounter and daily powers, which are scarce and therefore valuable. Players get frustrated when they use one of these powers, and then miss on their attack roll. While most of them provide some sort of secondary effect for missing, it's still frustrating. The best solution is to work with one's friends to set up combat advantages that give the power a better chance of hitting. Flank buddies were helpful in 3rd edition. They're critical in 4th. This level of teamwork does have its downside. It forces a more meta way of thinking. Players need to know what their allies have available in terms of power so that they can manipulate the battlefield accordingly. For example, a warlock teleporting into position, a fighter drawing attention of some nearby orcs, a warlord providing someone with an extra move just when they need it. It tended to switch people from a first-person to third-person perspective. One player, who ultimately disliked 4th edition, said that this made combat feel more like a video game and less like a role-playing game. I can't say I disagree. One effect that I did notice growing more prominent as the game went on was the binary nature of encounter and daily powers. Unlike at will powers, which are basically quick hits that you can use whenever you want, once you use an encounter or daily power, it's gone. There's no way to, say, stock up on fireballs because you know you're going to be fighting ice elementals, or to evoke Hunter's Bear Trap again to hinder an opponent because you missed the first time. I'd like to see some sort of mechanic, may it be action points, feats, or something else, that allows people a second or third chance at these powers, or simply allows them to stock up for a particular encounter. This problem is made worse by the loss of 3rd edition style scrolls and potions. There's no easy way to have an instant drinkable version of a power handy in case something goes wrong. Magic items provide some of this, as many of them have daily powers that people can draw upon, but they're as much one-trick ponies as the players are. In the end, low-level 4th edition combats ended up taking just as long as mid-level 3rd edition ones, which seems about right since they have comparable numbers of powers available. Where 4E likely wins out in the long run, and we haven't tried this yet so I can't confirm it, is that its level of complexity doesn't ramp up like 3rd edition's does. I expect the complexity to go up somewhat, say 20%, as you advance through the tiers in 4E, but nothing like what you have with epic-level characters in 3rd edition compared to 1st level characters. Dungeons & Dragons for Communists. Ultimately, it comes down to this. Forget about the exceptions-based game mechanic, ignore the missing classes and races, close your mind to the video game trappings. The single biggest difference between 4th edition and its predecessors is that this game isn't about you. It's not about your character and the cool things he can do. It's about your group. It's about making sure that no member of the team is significantly better or worse than anyone else. It's about a band of heroes coming together like a torch in the wilderness to fight back the horrors that lurk in the deep woods and under the towering mountains, and living to tell the tale because of teamwork. Every aspect of the game serves this fundamental, unifying theme. The homogeneity of the group is the reason why wizards and clerics no longer have their deep spell lists, why rangers lost their animal companions, and why every class now gains powers and abilities in lockstep with one another. 3E paid lip service to balance amongst the classes, but 4E delivers the real deal. As a result, no one can complain that the fighters dominate the game at low levels, or that wizards are godly at high ones, and that rogues are doomed to be caught between the two. Everyone is equal, and if you don't believe it, you can look at the power progression chart in the player's handbook. In our group, this focus on egalitarianism and teamwork led one of my friends to deem the new edition D&D for Communists. Jokes of no fighter left behind bounced around the table when we had our first character creation session, and as for me, when I read through the rules I couldn't help but thinking of Rush's The Trees, their satirical anthem to equality through force. The oaks really have been cut down to make room for the maples. There's a lot here that's borrowed from massively multiplayer online games like World of Warcraft, such as the aforementioned ability of paladins, fighters, rangers, and warlocks to work their abilities, and the naming conventions of powers, and the ability to reduce magic items to arcane dust for sale, or use in other magic items, which can be used to power even more new magic items. But really, this MMO stuff is just fluff masking a much bigger, more profound change in the game, which are the generification of the classes. While some classes have different roles in the game, they share the same level of complexity. This change goes over with folks who want their game and their characters focused on a specific subset of abilities, as well as those who resented the apparent power that clerics and wizards accumulated at high levels, at the expense, the argument goes, of fighters, rogues, and the rest of the martial classes, as well as those who never saw the point of 3E's extensive skill lists. For these folks, having core classes that offer two or at most three different paths to power is a major improvement. So are the rest of the changes that focus a character's capabilities by limiting said character's options. Fourth edition fails those who like the crunchy bits of playing a wizard or a cleric with a near infinity of magic items and spells to choose from, as well as those who love to build exactly the character they had in mind when they sat down at the table. Those who saw 3E's infinite multiclassing as a strength rather than as a weakness come into 4E, look at how many choices have been eliminated, and then scream bloody murder as they fumble with their idic charms. It's not a question so much of 4E being a bad game or a good game, as it is a radical difference in playstyles. It's created a rift amongst D&D players, and while a few new supplements might help bridge that by giving people more options, in the long run, 4E will never satisfy the 3E diehards because it is fundamentally a different design philosophy. Final analysis. I like 4E, but I don't love it. I think it's a bad fit for traditional campaign settings, including Greyhawk and Forgotten Realms, and works best with players who are tired of 3E, are looking for something more focused, and are willing to reboot their campaign. The game system is less flexible than its predecessor, and unlike 3rd edition, players will find themselves forcing their campaigns to fit 4E's playstyle rather than the other way around. If I were starting up a new D&D campaign with a new group of players, I might go with an Eberron 4E campaign, especially once the updated setting is released next year. But for now, 4th edition's off my active gaming radar.
Hi-ho! It's your favorite amphibious reporter with a helpful internet tip. Listening to the Geek Acres podcast can make you a well-rounded, hip, and fascinating individual. Go now to geekacres.libsyn.com. That's geekacres.libsyn.com. Your friends will be green with envy.
So that is my review of Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition. It's long, I admit, and I may have rambled on a bit in places, but ultimately, that's what I think of the new game. As I think I mentioned back in 70, my gaming group has decided not to go with Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition, and instead is going to be playing a Star Wars Saga Edition role-playing game. We plan on running a Star Wars campaign for the next year or so until Paizo releases their Pathfinder RPG, which is more of a spiritual successor to the 3.5 branch of Dungeons & Dragons and looks to be much more our style of play, but again, we'll see how things shake out with that. I'm always looking for comment and feedback on the show. You can find me online at Twitter, where I'm tweeting away most days. My username there is NukeHavoc, and you can find my page at www.twitter.com/NukeHavoc. You can reach me via Gmail at nuketown@gmail.com, and I'm even occasionally on Skype. My username there is Nuketown.